We live in a land of abundance. So much abundance, in fact, that we toss about 40% of our food we produce into the garbage. Garbage! And so today we pause to ask, how can we transform our garbage into gold?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Hello out there. You are tuned into the 1,168th edition of the Food Chain right here on the GCN Radio Network. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there in Lisbon who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio. Folks, those of us of a certain age were told by our stern-faced moms, eat everything on the plate, because there are children out there just like you who are going hungry tonight. They have no food. Well, there are still children out there going without food, but somehow we seem to have lost the import of mom's stern warning. And today, we waste about 40% of the food we produce. 40%. And it's not just the food that's being wasted. It's our time, our money, our know-how, and even the resources of our good Mother Earth. 40% we're throwing away. We are wasting so much food, our governments are passing laws that prevent us from throwing our food waste into municipal garbage dumps. And so today we pause to ask, how can we transform our garbage into gold? Who better to ask than Rhonda Sherman, who is an extension specialist at North Carolina State and author of the Worm Farmer's Handbook. Rhonda, welcome to the Food Chain.
Thank you very much, Michael.
Pleased to have you aboard. Before we go into the whole business about worms, I'd like you to tell us a little bit about what it is to be an extension specialist, because I think it's a very important service that our government provides our community, and most in the community probably don't even know about it.
Yes, unfortunately, even though it's been around for over 100 years, most people aren't aware of it. So it was over 100 years ago that Congress passed a law that said that every state will have a land-grant university, so one land-grant university in every state. And then a few years later, they also passed a law that said that traditional black colleges would have a land-grant university as well.
What exactly is a land-grant university?
Well, it means that Okay, so all universities have people who teach and do research, but at land-grant universities, you also have people who do what's called extension or outreach, and that means that the public doesn't have to pay for and enroll in a class to get information, to get research-based information from the university. They can just contact an extension specialist who will share that information with them.
Wow. That means all of this wonderful information is at our fingertips, right? All we have to do is pick up a phone call or go to the internet and connect with an extension specialist like you and get some guidance.
Yes. Yes. And so, like I said, every state has one or two land-grant universities, and then it depends on the state as far as county-based faculty. And so, for example, here in North Carolina, we're really blessed that all 100 counties plus our Indian reservation have cooperative extension offices that are they have faculty from the university who are housed in those county offices. And so people can contact their local. So if you live in Wake County, for example, you would contact your Wake County Cooperative Extension office, and they would provide assistance to you. And then you know, and then maybe if you needed more, you could contact the university. Mm-hmm. But the local extension agents should be the first ones that you contact. But, of course, nowadays it's so easy to just go on the Internet. And, for example, NC State University, we have so many publications and news articles and all sorts of free information that's right there on the Internet. So if you're wondering about how to improve your lawn or deal with diseases in your plants or trees or pests that are attacking your plants or trees, you can just go online, and there are all sorts of resources that tell you how to handle that.
And a lot of it's local knowledge, too, because these are county extension agents right there.
Yes, exactly. Yep.
So thank you very much for explaining that, because I think it's such a wonderful resource not many people know about, especially city people who just don't pay attention to those kinds of things. But there it is, county extension agents. Now, you are one, and you have a specialty, vermiculture. My goodness. When did you, like, wake up one day and decide to become a vermiculturist, Rhonda?
No. Actually, you know, back in the 70s, I studied environmental studies. And in the 80s, I decided to focus on solid waste reduction. So mm-hmm. that's keeping waste out of landfills. And so that's what I set out to do with my career. And I've been doing it ever since 1980. And in 1993, I was hired by NC State University to be an extension solid waste specialist. And it was because recycling had just been mandated in the state. Mm-hmm. And so people were contacting the land-grant university saying, how do I recycle? And it sounds kind of funny talking about that today, because most people know how to recycle, but back in 1993, they did not.
Well, so we've come a long way, haven't we?
Yeah, we have. Unfortunately, there are still those who don't recycle, but most people do. And so anyway, I noticed that all the talk was about cans, paper, and bottles. Okay? I would go to national conferences. That's all they talked about. They were ignoring food waste. And I found that really alarming. It's like, wait a minute. And so I started publishing extension fact sheets where I talked about how to reduce food waste. And this was back in the early 90s. And in 1994, I published a brief fact sheet that was called Worms Can Recycle Your Garbage. And it was one of seven fact sheets that I published, that I wrote and published that year. And my colleagues made fun of me. They were like, really? You wrote about worms?
When was this? What year? About what year?
This was 1994.
Okay, right. Okay, I gotcha. You wrote about worms?
It turned out to be, yeah, I just wrote about how to set up a worm mm-hmm. bin to yeah. handle your kitchen scraps. It flew off the shelves and it had to keep being reprinted. And then I started getting calls and emails from all over the world with people demanding to know more information about vermicomposting. So it changed the course of my career, because I didn't have time to do anything else but field all of these different calls about vermicomposting. So I started doing research on it. I started putting more articles on my website, and of course that was a chicken and egg thing. You know, I was doing it in response to requests, but by putting it on the internet, it actually attracted more people. So people in 110 countries have contacted me personally wanting to know more about vermicomposting.
So
it's
you
just really mindful how
really,
that happened.
You really didn't have an epiphany. It sounded like an epiphany had you.
Yes. Yes.
So there it was. All of a sudden, you become a worldwide authority on vermiculture. And we have about a minute left before we go to a break, but what exactly is vermiculture?
Okay, there's vermiculture and vermicomposting. So vermiculture is the culturing of earthworms for, and then you would, you know, sell them for bait or some other purpose.
Right, so you're growing worms.
Okay, you're growing and selling worms. And vermicomposting means that you're feeding the worms and you're using, you could sell the worms, but most people hold on to their worms, and but they use their manure, what the worms poop out, and they use that because it's a very valuable soil amendment.
Wow. Okay, folks, here we go. We're going to talk about how to turn our garbage into gold with Rhonda Sherman, who is an extension specialist with the North Carolina State University and author of the Worm Farmer's Handbook. Worms? Farming? Oh my goodness. We will be right back after these messages.
And now, back to What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, folks, we throw a lot of food away. Some say up to 40% of the food that we produce we throw away. And it's not just the food we're throwing away. It's all of our time and our money and our ingenuity and our know-how and our blood, sweat, and tears and the resources of Mother Earth. We're throwing it all away when we throw all that food away. And is it possible to recapture that and turn it back into the good stuff we put into it? That's the question on the table today. Rhonda Sherman is an extension specialist at North Carolina State. And she says, is it possible? Rhonda, what do you think? Can we turn that garbage back into gold?
Definitely.
Good.
It's the way to go.
Yeah. Good.
It's ridiculous to throw it away.
Well,
people don't realize how much harm is caused by throwing food in the garbage or putting it down sinks. Both cause very big environmental problems.
And it's
and
obscene.
People just aren't aware of it.
It's, if you think about it, it just seems to be obscene to be throwing away all of that effort and resources and everything right out the garbage. There it is, gone. So we can get it back. Now, one of the things that really captured my attention, Rhonda, was you are an advocate of large-scale vermiculturing, correct?
Well, yes, I'm an advocate of all scales, so mm-hmm. I also lecture and teach classes about small-scale vermicomposting and have fact sheets about that. So really, I have them for anyone, you know, for right. somebody who wants to do their kitchen waste. I have a curriculum for schools, so anyone who's working with children, whether it be in schools or church groups or scout groups or whatever, they can use that curriculum. And then there just wasn't information out there about mid- to large-scale vermicomposting, so I started concentrating on that. And for the past 19 years, I've held the only conference I'm aware of in the world that's an annual conference on mid- to large-scale vermicomposting. And I'm about to hold my 19th annual just this weekend. So it's a two-day event, and people, over 100 people show up from all throughout the United States and other countries. So over the years, people from 33 countries have attended my vermiculture conference.
Wow. Now, what fascinates me, of course, about the possibility of large-scale or industrial-scale vermiculturing is the fact that in certain places in the United States, you're no longer allowed to throw your food into the municipal dump, California
right.
being one. So if we can't throw our food away, what do we do with it?
Well, that's just it. We can manage it on site. You know, we can manage it inside our homes or in our backyards by either doing backyard composting or vermicomposting. So it's really easy for anybody to do. So I actually teach on both topics, composting and vermicomposting, mm-hmm. from small scale to large scale.
Well, that's interesting.
And I really advocate people doing it themselves, because if you're managing your food waste and your yard waste on, you know, in your yard or you know, on your balcony, if you have an apartment, then the city or county doesn't have to pay for trucks and people to come pick up your waste. You're actually just managing it on site. So it saves money for the city or county as well.
Plus, you can put it right back onto your property and make your property blossom. So
yes.
You just mentioned something that caught my attention, composting and vermiculturing. Essentially, same things, right?
No. They're very different. Yes, very different.
Tell us the difference then.
Okay. With composting, microorganisms are... With composting, it's supposed to go through a heating cycle,
right.
Okay? So microorganisms are consuming the organic materials, and their activity creates heat in the pile, and it helps the organic materials to break down and degrade and turn into a humus that's a very valuable soil amendment.
It's the glue that holds things together, right? Humus is.
Well, humus is, yeah. So it's humus and, you know, or other and elements are in it, you know, all sorts of nutrients and minerals and things that are healthy for the soil and for plants. And so composting is great, but also, there's vermicomposting. We refer to that as cold composting because you don't want it to heat up. So it's a shallow system that involves microorganisms and worms working together. But the materials ultimately are consumed by the worms. So you see how it's a different product?
Sure. Well, it's different in that microorganisms consume in the composting, but worms do the consuming in the vermiculturing, right?
Right. Well, and microorganisms.
Right.
So it's like the microbes are breaking down the organic materials, and the worms are eating the microbes and tiny particles of food. But it's passing through the worm, coming out the other end. It's stable, whereas... With compost, it goes through the heating cycle, and then it has to cure for a few months so that it is stable and the temperatures won't rise and burn your plants, whereas vermicompost is just ready to go when it comes out of the worm.
What do they love to eat, worms? What do they love to eat? What do they don't like to eat?
Well, I would say their worms' very favorite food is melon. They love melon. They also love certain types of animal manures. So they love, we say love, okay?
Sure.
We're being anthropomorphic because, you know, they don't love anything. But
or at least not
anyway,
that we know of, right?
They readily consume most types of animal manures. And I wrote about that pretty extensively in the book because for the mid to large scale operations that are taking place in the United States, the majority of people are feeding dairy manure to the worms.
Okay.
But there are all sorts of different types, like dairy manure is fine, horse manure, pig manure, llama, goat, sheep manure, all of those are fine for worms.
Okay.
You do not want to feed them chicken manure because it's just too high in ammonia.
Right.
You
don't want to put chicken manure on your lawn either because it'll burn it, right? A little bit too much.
Right.
Yeah. Now, what about kitchen scraps?
I mean, if they
like melons, they must like chicken scraps.
They do. Chicken scraps are fine, and that's what people are feeding them from their homes, in their offices. You know, they're putting their lunch scraps in there. There are schools in throughout California, for example, and I know of one in Pennsylvania where they're taking all of their cafeteria food scraps and feeding them to worms. And I write about that in the book. I also write about food scraps being fed from restaurants, from military bases, hospitals, nursing homes, all sorts of places are feeding worms. So maybe gardens, grocery stores, food banks, farms, colleges and universities.
So instead of throwing it away, they're changing it. They're transforming that garbage into a gold of sorts that can be used to rebuild the soil and bring life back to the soil. Folks, this is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with Rhonda Sherman, Extension Specialist, North Carolina State. When we come back, I'm going to ask how we do it on an industrial or large scale. Right back.
Let's go back for more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, we throw away a lot of food here in the city. A whole bunch of food, if you think about it. If you just look out the back of any restaurant and see the extent to which we throw food away there, and you go to the grocery store and watch them throw away all that produce, and 40% of the food that we make is estimated to be thrown. Rhonda, does that number sound real to you? 40%?
Oh yeah, unfortunately. I mean, it's mind-blowing, isn't it? I mean, 40%? That's ridiculous.
And, of course, folks, it's not just the food, but it's everything that we invest in that food to grow and produce it. It's our time. It's our money. It's our know-how. It's the resources of Mother Earth itself that we're being wasteful of. So how do we grab that waste and recycle it so that it becomes something incredibly valuable? Now, before we move on, how valuable is the worm castings to the soil? Tell us what value it has on the soil.
Oh, okay. Well, and first of all, I thought you were going to ask me about the value in terms of how much you can sell vermicompost for, because this is pretty incredible, too.
Because I guess they go together, don't they? First, tell us what it does for the soil,
and then we'll know why
people buy it, right?
Well, I just wanted to tell you this, because this is very interesting, the monetary value of compost versus vermicompost. The compost will sell for about up to $30 to $35 for a cubic yard, whereas vermicompost will sell for $200 to $1,800 per cubic yard.
Wow.
Big difference, huh?
Okay, so now the
take
reason,
that in and think
why,
about it.
Why? What do people see that's so valuable that they'll pay $1,800
like
for?
Like I said, it's a different process. So you have vermicompost that's coming out the other end of a worm, the castings. We call their poop castings. And so they're tiny fecal pellets, and they're mixed with organic material that was in the worm bin, and some of it may be undigested by the worms, but it still, you know, has decomposed. So we call it vermicompost. And it is just, it's teeming with microorganisms. And so the numbers of microbes and varieties of species of microbes is greater with vermicompost than it is with compost.
Wow.
So that's one super advantage, because those microbes are so beneficial to soil and plants. And so there is just a ton of information out there of scientific studies on how vermicompost can suppress disease attacks, so plant pathogens get repelled by the vermicompost. And a lot of that has to do with the numbers and varieties of microorganisms. But it also suppresses pest attacks. So,
you know the
different arthropods that go after plants.
You know what you sound like? You sound like the people with whom I talk to about the gut microbiome. And it, you say the same things. You know, it's that gut microbiome that protects you. It makes the food available to you. It protects you from diseases. And it's that's what you're saying, the same thing about the worm castings and the microbiota in the worm castings. It's what it does for the soil. So when people put that on the soil, it kind of inoculates the soil, doesn't it?
Yeah, you could say that. You know, and it just has so many properties, really too much to go into. But what vermicompost does for soil, it improves the soil structure and it increases the moisture infiltration. It improves and stabilizes the soil pH, and it increases the moisture holding capacity of soils.
So there
it is.
That's
just a short list of the things it does to soils. And then what it does with plants is it increases the rates of germination, growth, flowering, and fruiting. So you have fields. It improves the root development and stress tolerance. It decreases transplant shock. It increases plant vitality and the flavor profile. And then, like I said, it decreases attacks by plant pathogens, parasitic nematodes, and insect pests.
Wow. So that's why.
And you can go to Scholar. You know, people say, really? I didn't know this. Well, you just go to Google Scholar and just type in vermicompost effects on plants, and you'll get close to 30,000 scientific articles that have been published about how vermicompost affects plants.
So, okay, how do we take this vermiculturing to an industrial scale so we can serve cities? I'm thinking about coastal California, for example, where we're located right now. You have these giant metroplexes like the San Francisco Bay Area and the Southern California, Los Angeles to San Diego metroplex down there. You just have a tremendous amount of waste. How would we go about handling that with vermiculturing? I guess it would have to be kind of like neighborhood-sized operations or something.
Oh, there are so many ways of going about it, and it's interesting that you're talking about California because that's the ideal climate for vermicomposting, and more vermicomposting is taking place in California than any other state.
Why is it ideal?
And I've been out there several times. Oh. It's ideal because it's a milder climate. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you don't get larger, depending on where you live, you know, you're not socked in with winter and snow for months on end, you know?
Well, wait a minute. You know, I was raised
in
Montana, and we used to get worms to go fishing. So why couldn't you do it in Montana?
Oh, you can do it in Montana, but it's just harder to do it.
More difficult.
I were going to have an operation in Montana, I would want it to be inside a heated building. Whereas in California, you'll find people who have a quarter of an acre of land, and they've got outdoor windrows for vermicomposting. And there's a lot you can do on, you know, on even a quarter acre land. But I know of one site in California. It's over 200 acres, and they're doing about 30 to 50 acres of vermicomposting. That's a lot.
That's, well, if you're getting $1,800, I guess, you know, a yard, you could do stuff like that and make some money at it. Are people making money at it? Got to ask that when we come back. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What, with Rhonda Sherman. She's with the North Carolina Extension Service, and she is a specialist in vermiculturing, which is turning garbage into gold. So do stay tuned. We're going to find out if we can actually make some money turning garbage into gold on the food chain.
And now, more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, Rhonda, I just have to ask, who pays $1,800 a yard for worm casting? That's a lot of money. Who finds it?
It is a lot of money.
Who finds it that valuable?
Well, I mean, it's sold to a variety of places, like home improvement centers and nurseries and landscape contractors, greenhouses, garden supply stores, grocery chains, flower shops, discount stores, golf courses, vineyards.
I was wondering about golf courses.
Oh, they love it. They love vermicompost.
So to set up an industrial scale farm, what does it take? What do we need? What do we need to build?
Well, that's just it. If you're out in California, you can pay less money to get started than somebody in upstate New York, for example. Okay, because of your mild climate. So you can just, well, in fact, like I know of a farm, they've got like, I don't know, 800 acres or something. I mean, all sorts of people in California are doing really large-scale vermicomposting.
And they're doing it with windrows.
So you can do windrows, and all you need is 6 inches of some type of stable bedding. So a lot of people will use finished compost. So you just lay down the finished compost 6 inches deep, no wider than 8 feet, because you need to be able to inspect the worm bed and be able to see the worms in the middle. So 8 feet is as wide as you would want to go to be able to lean over and see. Like for me, I have back issues, so I wouldn't want to, I would have a narrower windrow. But then the windrow can be as long as the space that you have.
Wow, sure, so you just keep pouring material on and feeding the worms then.
Yes.
Now,
so there's somebody in Northern California who was featured on the TV show called Blue Collar Millionaire. So if you look up Blue Collar Millionaire, a whole can of worms, you'll see this family in Durham, California, and they have what's called the Worm Farm, and they've become millionaires from selling vermicompost and compost.
Wow. So it's for real then. I just think of golf courses. What a wonderful material for golf courses, because they have such trouble with the chemical intensive soil technologies they use. And actually, it seems like worm castings are an antidote to those chemicals. Am I wrong? It seems like
they are an antidote. Yes. So the worm castings and people who make worm casting tea. So golf courses will use both. Vermicompost and the teas.
And of course, that's a fertilizer tea. It's not a drinking tea, right?
Exactly. Right. Uh-huh. Right. You wouldn't want to drink it.
You wouldn't want to.
But it probably wouldn't
be bad if you did. When it gets right down to it, I don't know.
I'm not going to advocate that.
You're not going to go there. Okay. Fair enough.
No. But you need finished vermicompost that you carefully brew, we call it brewing, to create vermicompost tea. I'm mentioning this because some people will call drippings from worm bins worm tea or casting tea, and it's not. It's leachate, and it could harm plants. So it's important to be careful about how you intentionally brew vermicompost tea.
Now, you have these designs on your North Carolina Extension website, right? So we could Google Rhonda Sherman or we can look at your the Worm Farmer's Handbook and find this information of how to go about doing this, right?
Yes, definitely. Yes.
My website
has a ton of information that will keep you busy for days on composting and vermicomposting. And I have videos and publications And so it's important to just take some time to click around and see all that's there. But it's divided into small scale and larger scale.
But, you know, the essence, the technology can't be too difficult, because when it gets right down to it, the worms do all the work. All you have to do is feed them, and they take care of the business. Now, there has to be garbage in and garbage out too. You have to think about what you're feeding and what should you not feed worms in your worm casting effort.
Well, it depends on the scale that you're doing, because having a small worm bin is different from a larger worm bin. A larger worm bin is more forgiving than a small worm bin.
Ah. You don't get the concentration of effect then. So if you put something bad in a little one, you're in trouble in a major scale.
Well, for example, on a small scale, we're talking about a bin that's 10 or 14 gallons, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, like a small tote bin that you would buy at a store. And so for that, I tell people, don't put in meat, grease, bones, or dairy products, because, you know, that could attract carnivores. Don't put in cat or dog feces, because we know those have pathogens. And then citrus fruits and rinds, for example, I would not put into a small bin.
Okay, we're going to have to hold that.
A large bin.
We're going to hold that. I'm going to take a quick break. When we get back, the fantasy.
We're on the farm with Joel Salatin.
Would you like to buy homemade soup, backyard chicken, and the neighbor's artisanal lunch meat? The Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund protects your right to acquire the food of your choice from the source of your choice. I'm Joel Salatin from Polyface Farm, and I urge you to defend the right of neighbors to engage in direct food commerce. Join today at farmtoconsumer.org. The food of your choice. From the source of your choice. That's farmtoconsumer.org. Farmtoconsumer.org. Thank you.
When you buy local American-grown flowers, flowers will grow and flourish in America. Hello, I'm Deborah Prinzing, author of Slow Flowers for Certified American-Grown Flowers. When you buy local flowers, you're helping our country's family farms reduce the transportation footprint of flowers and enjoy fresher, longer-lasting bouquets. So please, next time you shop for flowers, think local. Think Certified American-Grown Flowers. Visit AmericanGrownFlowers.org to learn more.
You can dream it, build it, own it, Metro Farm it. You can sow it, feed it, grow it, Metro Farm it. Ah, you can harvest it and dry it. You can sell it, Metro Farm it.
Learn how to dream it, build it, sow it, seed it, grow it, harvest it, sell it, Metro Farm it. Yes, you can do it. Dream it, build it, earn it, own it, Metro Farm it.
Oh, learn it, do it, earn it, Metro Farm it. Dream it, build it, own it. It's easy, you can do it, Metro Farm it.
It's all in Metro Farm, the guide to growing for the city. Get your copy today at metrofarm.com.
It's easy, you can do it, Metro Farm it.
So much to say, so little time to say it, on The Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, when I was talking with Rhonda before the show, I mentioned that I had this fantasy about worm castings, and she kind of thought, uh-oh, this looks like trouble, but it probably is. But I do have this fantasy, and the fantasy is this. We hear in California, we have these big, huge, giant metropolitan areas that are consuming lots of food, but throwing away lots of food. 40% of the food that we produce, we throw away. My fantasy is, what if we could take that tremendous amount of waste and reinvest it into the desert soils of like Nevada and Arizona? Would it be possible to bring life back to those desert soils with this incredibly rich soil amendment of worm castings? What do you think, Rhonda?
Oh, definitely. Yeah.
You really think it
I
is?
Like your, Tuesday. That's great. Yeah, because, you know, it's interesting. People will contact me and say, I don't have any, I bought a house, and they totally took all the topsoil away to build the house, and then they planted things, and the things they planted are not growing. And I noticed I have no earthworms. Can I just buy earthworms and sprinkle them around my yard, for example? And I'll say, no. There's a reason why you don't have earthworms. And that would be, you may as well drive down the highway and throw money out of your car. Because if you put earthworm, if the worms are not naturally there, it means there's a problem. And you have to fix the problem. And just injecting worms doesn't help, because obviously your piece of land is lacking what the earthworms need.
So
by incorporating compost and vermicompost, it's going to improve the soil in all the ways I mentioned earlier, and that'll improve everything, the soil and the plants, and you'll attract earthworms.
So if we were to just go to Arizona and out there to the deserts of Arizona or Nevada or whatever and throw some worms out there in the soil, they would croak because there's nothing there for them to live on, which is why there's not many plants out there. It's not much to live on. But if we start inoculating that soil with all of the food that we throw away in the big cities, just think of all that energy. Oh, my goodness. So is that a fantasy that's just crazy?
Well, I wouldn't spread raw food waste in areas, but by converting the food waste to compost or vermicompost, then you have a stable product that you can incorporate into the soil.
Well, Rhonda Sherman, what fun. Wish we had about 3 more hours to talk about.
We're I wish we did too.
Because it's, to me, it's always been this wonderful fantasy about taking this waste and turning it into gold and into such a valuable soil nutrient that it literally brings life back to dead soil. And soil is the foundation upon which we build everything. So just the notion of taking our waste and using it that way instead of taking it to the dump and throwing it away, literally. Wow. So, Rhonda Sherman, North Carolina State, the Worm Farmer's Handbook. Pick it up. Let's reinvigorate our earth with some worm casting. Thank you so much, Rhonda.
Thank you, Michael. I really appreciate it.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.